Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role can women play in leading the journey toward peace and prosperity after violent conflict? Around the world, civilians make up an estimated 90% of war casualties, and fully three-quarters of those affected are women and children. But my guest today is adamant that women need not simply be victims of such traumas when, with support and education, they can become true leaders in their families and their communities. Afshan Khan is CEO of Women for Women International, which serves women from the Balkans to Afghanistan to sub-Saharan Africa with human rights education, business training and microlending, and the formation of social support networks. She's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tomorrow, and we are delighted she could make time for us this afternoon. Afshan, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me here.
Talk about how the welfare of women relates to the overall stability of a society.
Women for Women has found that it's incredibly important to have women engaged in peace processes. It's very clear that we've seen over the number of years that women have been portrayed often as victims of war. Mm-hmm. Probably nowhere is this more acute than Democratic Republic of Congo, where you've had the massive use of rape to intimidate both women, families, and communities. But we also recognize that women are important agents of peace. They can help in terms of preventing conflict through early warning, grassroots organizations being used to dissipate conflicts before they flare to a larger scale. I think in terms of protection, there's a really important peacekeeping role for women. We often see men as peacekeepers. I think a broader engagement of women in police and in the military is a way of creating a better safety net for women. It's very hard for women to come forward and speak to some of the things that are happening to them in camps or in confined areas, and if there are men in front of them. It's much easier if there's women. And then participation in peace negotiations. Mm-hmm. There's a real need to bring women in as mediators, as negotiators, and there's very, very few where that's the case. And then finally, I think in relief and recovery efforts themselves. Women can be empowered and be inclusive in terms of helping transform and build back peace. And one of the key things in sustaining peace is investing in health, in education, in some form of economic empowerment and employment. Because when people see a positive change, when they see their kids going to school, their health needs taken care of, basic water and sanitation and food on the table, then keeping that peace is much better than resorting back to war.
You know, we had the Nobel laureate Lema Bowie on the show a few months ago, and she, in telling her story, conveyed her frustration with the idea that, yes, the people who made the war were the people also who were initially allowed to decide the terms of the peace. And ultimately what that does is keep very often the sort of key core issues that caused conflict in the first place from being truly resolved.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think the second component of that is also having women at the negotiating table. Make sure that you take issues that are causes of conflict, bring them to the fore. But more importantly, you don't polarize the debate between the same guys who started the conflict in mm-hmm. the first place. Mm-hmm. You end up with adding value to a peace process. And women are the fabric of society. They are the custodians of the next generation, and their mothers, their wives, and their economic and social agents of change. So capturing that as part of the peace negotiating process is pivotal, because otherwise you end up with two very, very polarized political perspectives that were party to the conflict, with nothing external that can help create the transformation and change that's needed.
I have to imagine, Afshan, too, that it is an investment in the sort of psychosocial development of the next generation of young men and young women when they see their mothers at the negotiating table and recognize that women are being valued in an equal way with men and that they can exercise power, that they deserve power. It sort of changes the way these young people are growing up and forming their own societies.
Absolutely. I think we cannot underestimate role models, and not just for girls, for men as well. many of the violations that are perpetrated against women are by men, and in many places they're by young men. And those men have an incredible trouble reintegrating back into society once the war is over, particularly if they've been young child soldiers. They have no understanding of what the relationship is with young women or girls because they were taken from their families so early. And their only experience is either one of killing, maiming, or sexual rape. Mm-hmm. So for that next generation to be able to understand, and for that generation of children who were child soldiers to be able to understand the positive influence of women, they need to see them in constructive roles in society. Otherwise, you're never going to address that imbalance, and you will have a wound and a scar that festers for generations.
I promise we will talk at great length about the specific programs of Women for Women International for women and girls. But talk, if you would, about this. It almost seems like a stealth program that you have going, at least in Afghanistan and perhaps in other countries as well, the Men's Leadership Program. Can you tell us about how that works?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Part of what we recognized working with women in communities was a big part of what needed to change was not dependent on women alone. Mm-hmm. It also required support from communities, and it required a transformation in the environment within which women were working. So we recognized that training women on literacy awareness, on basic health, on a vocational skill was all very well and did a lot to build up a woman's self-worth, her confidence, her understanding of her own value and potential. But then she was working within an environment, a community, a cultural, a political, a social context that actually drove what was possible, mm-hmm. whether those trainings could be optimally used. And in a place like Afghanistan, we recognize that unless we convinced men leaders, and that's mullahs, community leaders, that women enrolling in the program was important, but also even more important, once those women had graduated the program, that they needed community and men's support in order to make that training turn into something positive for their families, that men's support was crucial. So we launched a program, first in Afghanistan, that looked really at men's leadership, working with mullahs to try and convince them about the importance of women's rights, recognizing that women are mothers, are sisters, are wives. So one simple way of saying it is if your young daughter doesn't go to school and she is then the mother of the next generation of your son, when he comes home and needs help with his homework, she can't do that. Mm-hmm. When you need somebody to help earn a living to put enough food on the table, she can't do that. So it's also helping that broader understanding. Similarly, in Congo, we had a men's program that focused on informing military soldiers what was the impact of what was happening in those communities with respect to rape and sexual and gender-based violence, and how it was not only tearing apart the societies, but wounding the next generation in a way that we would be unable to address it unless they took action, unless they set standards, unless there were role models, unless the impunity gap that currently exists with respect to taking action by commanders when their soldiers behaved inappropriately, there would not be a long-term building back or trust of the of those communities, of the military or the soldiers or the governors or any other people who were in positions of authority.
So how do you get these guys to the table in either a heavily militarized or deeply patriarchal culture?
I think it's an important part of negotiation. And all our offices are staffed by nationals of that country, mm-hmm. from the leadership down.
So it doesn't feel like someone's coming in from outside and telling you what to do.
It's not someone coming in from outside telling you what to do. It is recognizing that there is a potential program that can help transform the community. It's the respect of going and explaining what that program is. It's sharing the curricula. It's discussing how these community elders, leaders, can support and help move forward this agenda, and how their influence will be even greater if they're seen to be playing a broader, more inclusive role for all of society.
So talk about this. In addition to business skills training and human rights education and health education, there is this social component that turns out to be, it sounds like maybe the glue that holds it all together.
I think it is. I mean, there's one point to remember. Basically, you have 25 women together in a class who are going through a 12-month program, mm-hmm. a cycle that looks at all of the elements you've just outlined, that women are well, that they learn life skills, that their knowledge of health is improved, they earn an income, as well as know their rights, and then very importantly, that they form networks and associations. And that's because once they graduate, they need to know that there's a support base along them. Think of them like your graduating class mm-hmm. from university or high school, mm-hmm. where all of a sudden you have a support network that you can turn to. You are not alone. Some of the women will go in business together. Others will pool their assets to buy land and then produce goods. And very importantly, I was deeply touched when I went to Kosovo a couple of weeks ago. I spoke to a number of women who said that it is only now, after 14 years after the war, that having this community of women, I can open myself up and speak about what happened. Because prior to that, I was so worried about getting our lives back, rebuilding our home, putting food on the table, getting the kids through school. If I had thought about what had happened to me, I would have driven myself crazy.
Yeah.
And now that around me, things have stabilized, I'm able to talk to other women who will not judge me, who will no longer say, it's a shame what happened to that family, but they will understand and share my experience and help my healing.
So what does that year look like, those 12 months of training?
Those 12 months of training are basically, it's a core program with a couple of days a month where women come for a specific class. And those classes range from a series of issues around nutritional issues, what to eat, reproductive health, it's a big issue as well, where to access those services. Then it'll get into a vocational training curriculum, and those vocational training skills will be based on what is a viable opportunity in that market. So it may be baking bread, it may be growing crops for sale. It may be sewing and embroidery, or it may be producing goods that can then be exported to a market or stores in the U.S. and Europe. So there's a vocational training piece. And then the third piece is awareness of rights. One of the things we've realized is that many societies have very clear rights enshrined in their constitution, particularly post-conflict societies. Again, I'll use Kosovo as an example. There's all kinds of legal stipulations that have been put in to enforce and make sure that women have rights in that society with respect to inheritance of land and all other sorts of things. What's happened is there's an implementation gap mm-hmm. because women don't know what their rights are. And this is a way to make awareness of that right, the rights clear, and to make sure that they have the social networks to then demand those rights.
We're speaking this hour with Afshan Khan, who is CEO of Women for Women International. She's in town for an address tomorrow to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find details at dfwworld.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is CEO of Women for Women International, Afshan Khan. She's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tomorrow. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about the story of Malala Yousafzai, the teenager who was attacked in Pakistan for speaking out in defense of girls' right to an education. It seems, Afshan, that she is both a symbol of this power that young women are beginning to feel to speak out for their rights, and also a symbol of how much is stacked against them in particular societies.
Absolutely. I think part of the challenge is that education is the key to building peaceful and stable societies. And educating girls introduces them to a new way about thinking about their communities, the challenge and challenging the traditional gender roles. So on the one hand, education is incredibly pivotal and transformative in society. On the other hand, I think there are forces who would like to see the status quo kept and realize that the potential of educating girls and young women and having their full participation in society will challenge authority and traditional norms in a way that they aren't necessarily comfortable with. But equally, we've seen such successes when women have been engaged in societies, educated, then become part of peace building and become part of the fabric of society, so that not only are there decision makers and shared decisions with men in their communities is the best way to build back peace.
How do communities change just from an economic perspective when women who have been largely kept out of the workforce are suddenly part of it?
We have some very strong evidence recently. A study was done of Women for Women's programs in Congo and in Rwanda. And in that study, it showed that investing in women and economic inclusion of women had a multiplier effect not just on improving women's incomes. We have very clear metrics, for example, that an individual woman, when she starts our program, earns on average 24 cents a day. Hmm. By the time she graduates that program, her earning is well above $1.25 a day. But the study showed not only is there an impact on women, but there's a multiplier effect and an impact on communities. That many of these women, when they earn an income, they spend it in their communities. Second, and invest in things like education, health, nutritional status for their kids. Secondly, these women go on to build businesses or form associations or cooperatives with other women and employ them as well. And then much of the investment tends to stay within the community. Mm-hmm. So you get a third multiplier effect. So the halo effect of investing in women and girls is absolutely exponential. And you'll see it now on the debates, for example, on increasing food production. It's very clear that, you know, women have very, very little investment in terms of agricultural credit or access to land, even though they are the majority of people who work on farms to produce food. And it's very clear that with the right access to credit, fertilizer, technical assistance, and access to land, we could actually double production or triple production in many instances. So I think this multiplier effect of investing in women has been quite well documented, but it's clear that they're not just economic returns, but they're social returns as well. So women tend, the minute they make money, to invest in their children going to school, in better health care for themselves and their families. And when they spend money, they spend it on assets that bring something to the entire household. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've seen, for example, in Rwanda, 100% of the women in the Women for Women International program are banked. That means they receive a small training stipend of $10 a month, and that's put into a bank account for them. They then learn about the importance of savings. If they save a portion of that, then they're able to invest it in either buying a cow or chickens or something that will then render further income to their household. And more importantly, if they're banked, they then have a history which allows them to access savings, or if they pool their resources, to have better access to resources to invest collectively or individually to grow their businesses.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Andy in Dallas. Hello, Andy.
Good afternoon.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Your guest said that she had to convince the mullahs that women are wives, mothers, daughters, and sisters. So you had to fight on two fronts, on the men's front as well as on the women's front. Why did she have to convince anybody that the woman is a wife or a mother or a daughter? And where did those men get their perceived notions about the women?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. For me, what was clear was that they knew that they had wives, daughters, mothers, and sisters. The potential was what those wives, mothers, daughters, and sisters could do to help build back a peaceful and stable society in Afghanistan. So their roles as mothers, wives, and sisters were very, very clear. I think their value as potential partners in transforming communities and creating stability and peace is something that the mullahs want to talk about more to understand where the potential for that could come and how best this could be done jointly within the community.
How do the programs vary based on the country in which they are set up and the differences in culture, in existing levels of literacy or education? Do you tailor the classes depending on where you're working?
Very much so. And it's absolutely crucial when we're talking about rights, for example, because the legal systems in each country differ.
Sure.
The cultural norms differ. The social standards differ. So when women are learning about their rights, we will often bring in people from the university or from the community or from the municipality who have a solid understanding of what the domestic laws are. In Nigeria, we have translated, for example, into different languages of the different where we operate so that there's a solid understanding of what the legal codes in Nigeria mean in the tribal languages where we are operating.
And in terms of health information, I suppose there's information about, as you mentioned, contraceptives and things like that. How do you help women who may not be able to afford medical care but can recognize when they need it?
I think partly it's understanding where there are referral services.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of countries where medical care is part of a program that has been set up. I'll give Rwanda as an example. The government has established a national health insurance system. Everybody pays a small proportion. Often we see women will save part of the training stipend to actually enroll themselves and their family in that system and then get access to referral services. We have other areas. Congo is a good example, where there are few or little government services available. So then we'll make sure that women are aware of where there are referral services, such as health clinics set up by churches or hospitals where they can be treated and that they have access to those services. So that's a crucial part of expanding out our program in partnership with others. Because while Women for Women International may be building up awareness and the demand for those services, it's clear that there are several other entities and partners, whether it's government, whether it's faith-based NGOs, whether it's community-based NGOs or international NGOs, where those services can be provided. That's a crucial part of linking women to not only understanding what their health needs are, but making sure they understand where they're available.
How do you decide, once you have established a program within a particular country, how do you decide which communities to put these programs in? And then when resources are limited, which applicants are accepted into the program?
Yeah, this is a really, really difficult one because partly we have, for example, worked very closely with governments and communities to select those areas where women are most socially excluded.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really working at the base of the pyramid. with communities that have been severely affected by conflict or extremely vulnerable women. So they may be widows, they may have a high dependency burden in terms of the number of children they're caring for, or they may have someone with a chronic disease or disability in their home. So part of that is working with the local communities to identify which households are most vulnerable, or where municipal services exist to identify those households. The second, and perhaps the most heart-wrenching, is when we can only enroll, say, 500 women and 1,000 women turned up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my recent experience when I went to Afghanistan. I was in Istalaf, which is a community about an hour and a half outside of Kabul. And, you know, we had worked with the local leaders to say we were coming on X day, and they had identified and made the call out to women to come to enroll. And we have a 7 to 8 page enrollment form that checks men at much of the household level data before deciding whether we will enroll a woman. But we had a call for 500 women, 1,000 women turned up. Hmm. So I had to be shuttled into a small room at the back in order not to be crushed. And while I sat while they asked many of the women questions in their local languages to then decide which of those we would enroll in this cycle and which we would have to defer until we had additional resources to be able to cast a wider net.
Mm-hmm. What have you learned about women who go through the program and even on an informal basis sort of share what they've learned with their sisters, with their neighbors, with people within their own communities?
There's been a lot of learning and sharing of learning with other women. I think one of the most extraordinary things that I have seen, and we also again have data to show this, is that once women graduate, there's a tendency to inform and share that knowledge with other women. There's also a tendency in businesses not just to congregate with the women whom they were in a class with, but to share that learning and bring other women into businesses where women have set up businesses. So I was also in Eastern Congo in August. And at that point, we met a group of women who had pooled their resources to buy a grinding mill to grind grain.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just outside of Bukavu, about 2 hours outside of Bukavu. And then when we got to that community, I had realized that one woman who was a graduate of the program had brought together at least 10 other women, none of them who had participated in the program, to train them up, to share their assets, and to pool those assets to create that grinding mill. Now, much of Eastern Congo is really dependent on small trade because big businesses and investment, given the current political and security climate, aren't really present. So women came from across the lake who were buying bread. They ended up being Women for Women graduates as mm-hmm. well. So the two groups got together, sat down and talked, ended up spending the entire night in the same community, and then talked about how they would establish a value chain whereby the grain that was ground by one group of women will be sold exclusively to the women who were baking bread on the other side so that they could capture the market and keep their profits within this wider group of women. And then they, again, would go out and reach out to additional women to expand that market.
That's pretty sophisticated business.
Absolutely. And this is women with, you know, very basic numeracy and literacy skills. So I think it just shows the power and potential to transform if just given the right opportunity.
Afshan Khan is my guest. She's CEO of Women for Women International. Let's go back to the phones at 1-800-933-5372. We have Harvey on the line now in Murphy. Hello, Harvey.
How are you girls doing?
Very well, thank you.
What we have, I'm involved in doing some work in Haiti. And one of the situations we have there with the women is the girls, first thing is that the education has to be paid for, so there's tuition. And tradition says that if you're going to invest in a child, you invest in a male child. So there is not the money there to invest in a girl to traditionally to go to school. But then there's also the reality that the women do the chores. So we have a situation where the girls cannot go to school because they got to haul water. They've got to do all of the non-paying work. And it's an interesting challenge to try to overcome. My suggestion was we set up whiteboards at the water trucks. And that way, when the young ladies get there, they can get part of a lesson. When they come back, they can get the other part of it.
Wow, that sounds like a great idea. What do you think, Afshan?
I think it's a wonderful idea. There's tremendous different ways of adjusting learning to deal with some of the community-type responsibilities that women and girls have. Another way that's often been used by governments or communities or agencies working on education is to adjust school hours during the harvest season, for example, because often girls are working on as agricultural laborers. The other is to make sure that, you know, there's a better understanding of making sure that girls have time to go to school and yet keep their chores and responsibilities as well. Sometimes pooling or sharing assets is another way of dividing that up amongst different girls within the family. The second is also to recognize the importance of education in investing longer term, that a girl who does get educated does have the potential longer term to have a much more important role in her family and community as an earner if she does have her workload reduced. So I think there's issues on adjusting timing for schools, but there's also potential to really make sure that some of these basic services reach the communities where they're needed so girls can go to school.
Afshan Khan is my guest. She's CEO of Women for Women International. She'll speak tomorrow to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can check out the details at dfwworld.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Afshan Khan. She's CEO of Women for Women International. She'll be speaking tomorrow to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org. Afshan, how much does it cost to send a woman through the program for a year?
We have, most of our women have sponsors, so they're matched with sponsors in the U.S. or the U.K. that support these women. So we have a sponsorship fee of about $30 a month, which enrolls a woman for that 12-month program. Now, that basically covers the variable costs of having a woman attend the class, includes part of that training stipend that I mentioned earlier. But it doesn't cover the fixed costs of the organization to have offices because we actually implement on the ground in the communities where we operate. So there's a slight differential in terms of being able to cover those costs as well.
Mm-hmm. And so people who want to get involved with the organization can go online?
Absolutely. They can go online. Sponsorship is one of the key ways that we have of financing women's enrollment in that core program. It's crucial. I think it also builds a really strong and vibrant one-to-one connection between women. There's a real opportunity to learn from a woman herself through a letter that she will write to her sponsor sister about what are some of the struggles of her daily life, what are some of her opportunities, what are some of her dreams. And I think there's such a connection between women in terms of what they share as their hopes for their children, in terms of what they share as dreams for their own profession, that it's a really enriching experience at both ends of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. You know, you're providing an opportunity, an angel investment, for example, to a woman in many of these countries. But equally, I think this woman is providing the richness of her narrative, her history, her story, of which you are now a part of and can help make a change.
Do some of them stay in contact after the sponsorships end?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think we have two things that have happened. We've seen many sponsors after the one-year enrollment ends sometimes help women start their businesses if their businesses are able to succeed. And then secondly, we've also seen the other side where women have been so happy with their sponsor sister in one country that they have then gone on to support women in other countries or another woman in the same country. So there's a tremendous power and potential for change beyond the individual woman to kind of bring about enough critical mass and enroll enough women to make a significant change.
As a working parent, I have to ask, is there childcare for women who have very little kids?
It's an interesting concept. It's one of the things we explored when we first started. And then we realized that in order to provide it adequately, the cost of these services would be prohibitive.
Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't be able to do it if you did childcare?
Not to do it well, mm-hmm. because it would mean also ensuring that child was fed, et cetera, had a safe roof to play. So what we have done is, where possible, worked with municipalities to make sure those services are provided. The second thing we've done is really encourage women to enroll their children in school or early childhood care if it's available. And that is something that, again, the training stipend can help support. And then the other thing that we've seen is we have often seen women look at child care or early childhood care, particularly for younger kids, as an opportunity to start their own business.
Hmm.
So where women can say, fine, I'm going to take care of these 20, 30 children in this day, in this space, it does require policies and standard settings, so it's a safe place for children. But that is also another economic opportunity, because women end up doing most of the child and elder care. And if they are able to get municipal support to create that safe space for kids, it's a win-win.
We have an email here from a listener who asks, what type of support is provided for women in Cambodia? Do you have operations in Asia at all?
We do, but only in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. We don't work in Cambodia.
I would imagine you have 8 countries now. I mean, is that at this point with the size of the organization, is that where you're going to stay for the foreseeable future?
I think for us, the challenge is, do we go broader in the country we're in? So, for example, in Congo, we have approximately 10,000 women enrolled, in Afghanistan, 6,000, in Rwanda, 6,000. There is the possibility to be much more deep into different parts of the country mm-hmm. than where we are already. Or there's an opportunity to go into new countries. And I think first and foremost, we have a commitment to serve to the best potential we can the women where we are. I think there is a challenge for the organization to respond to its humanitarian roots, which were the origin, where Zainab Salbi, our founder, actually went into Bosnia just before the conflict ended to help support women at that time. I think there are opportunities for us to expand into ongoing conflict situations, but it will really require additional resources to be able to do that. And right now, we do not have the people, money, to reach a larger target group.
Talk about the process. You mentioned that the people who are administering these programs in the individual countries are natives of those countries. By what criteria do you choose? It seems like it would have to be a very special person to organize these programs in individual countries.
We have some incredible women leaders in the countries where we work. And I think the selection process is a competitive one. But there's many women who both have the presence and understanding and profound knowledge of their own countries and cultures and what it'll take to build back peace or build peace. Secondly, many of them do have the managerial skills that are needed. And if they don't, we actually have a process of accompanying them and supporting them from headquarters. And thirdly, I think to refer back to some of your earlier callers, the cultural understanding of the context within which you work is so important, particularly as you're bringing about this transformational change, which looks at women in a holistic way, on issues on health, reproductive health, on rights, on economic empowerment, on community participation, that it really means that you have to understand what it'll take to engineer that change in your country. So while the leadership is important, I think the team is also very important. And we've really looked at skills that are complementary within the office to be able to scale up those programs. We've looked at partnering locally with other organizations mm-hmm. who offer services that we don't, and to make sure that the full spectrum of social, economic, political, and cultural rights of women are adequately addressed.
What do you learn, Ashan, by getting on the ground and visiting women in the countries and that you serve that you couldn't learn even through the most devoted sort of study from your office in Washington?
I think there's a couple of things. One, you know, studies often tend to neutralize the connectivity, the emotional power, the impact. They're very good at metrics, at measuring, for example, what's been the change of status in terms of income, what has been the number of women who are present in municipalities. What it doesn't easily capture is the narrative and the story. It doesn't always capture the dreams of where women would like the program to go. So sitting down with focus groups of women and saying what is working well, what is not. Even in contexts where we have people that are part of that culture and community, there are differences within countries, amongst cultures and communities based on region, based on ethnicity. And to understand profoundly how those dynamics play out within a community requires listening and learning. So it's not just my listening and learning, but it's also the listening and learning of the teams on the ground to adapt the program to serve the needs of the context, cultural, economic, and social within which we work. I'll give you a practical example. Mm-hmm. In Kosovo, we really built out the business element of our program because women had a basic level of literacy and numeracy. There was awareness of the rights. There was an implementation gap. So we realized that what we needed to really do was work more with municipalities. We needed to make sure that the business skills of women were better honed, and we needed to make sure that they had access to credit. The situation in Congo was quite different. Mm-hmm. None of the systems and structures were in place. So we needed to adapt that program to be able to deal with what were the current dynamics of that community. So in northern Kivu, around Goma this summer, there were real problems with rebel groups and additional attacks, which made it very difficult for women to get to class and made it very difficult for our trainers to get out there.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to adjust our schedules, make sure that we were responsive enough to women's needs so they could still learn what they needed to do to earn, but without the risk to the safety and security that is so crucial a part of their day-to-day reality.
There's been so much discussion in recent years about the effectiveness of foreign resources being applied to problems overseas. And I'm thinking about USAID and other government-run programs to inject foreign aid. Can you talk about what you've learned about the best way to put these resources to work and whether there are better sorts of checks and balances to ensure that human beings are really benefiting from the resources that governments are investing in foreign countries?
I think there's been a tremendous amount of work done recently on strengthening and accountability structures and systems.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what I think people have learned as well is that often bundling services and dealing with, for example, women as a whole, not just their health issues, not just
right.
their social issues, not just their rights issues, but bundling makes a difference. Working more at community and local levels makes a difference. So technical assistance, capacity building in that country for those countries' nationals whether it's civil society, whether it's support to government, or whether it's support to the private sector to help deliver some of the services that are so essential, are parts of building back peace, and that while technical assistance from overseas has a role, it's very specific and time-bound.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a necessity to really empower nationally individuals in these countries to take on a lot of this work, and more importantly, to create positive incentives for things like investing in health and education and nutrition, so that when governments do provide financial support and assistance, provide it to the right things. Provide it to the things that are going to have long-term value in transforming society, not short-term value in stability and military prowess.
It sounds like it goes right back to your organization's decision to go deep rather than broad if you have to make a choice.
It's part of the choice, and it's a difficult choice. It's one we struggle with. When we see conflicts now in a place like Syria, for mm-hmm. example, there's obviously a tremendous need for the type of integrated program Women for Women International has. There are an opportunity, and it's probably an opportunity we'll discuss in the future, of adapting our model to work more in camps. And then
IDP camps.
IDP mm-hmm. camps, and then see if we can follow those women back into their communities later on. It's one of the things we're grappling with in the Kivus now, with more than a million people displaced in the north. Does a fixed asset model in a place where people do have to flee fighting work best, or can we be agile enough to adapt to the reality of the context where these women live?
So you don't necessarily have to wait for a conflict to mostly settle down before you can enter a country?
You do for a full 12-month program.
Uh-huh.
You don't if you take a program that's agile enough to work with women where they are and then go back into their communities later on. Let me take a practical example again. Uh-huh. Panzi Hospital. There's a doctor there that works with women from all over who have suffered fistula as a result of rape or pregnancies or sexual violence, repeated pregnancies. So sometimes what we have been able to do is identify women coming out of that hospital who may be vulnerable and are going back into the communities where we work
mm-hmm.
and make sure they're included in the program. Equally, there's an opportunity to identify women in IDP camps who can be community leaders to help the program when they get back to their communities.
Afshan Khan is CEO of Women for Women International. She will speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tomorrow at 11:30. Afshan, thank you so much for spending your time with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it as well.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell does the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Find out about upcoming programs and download the podcast free every day at kera.org/think. Send comments to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.